Well, welcome to all of you. And as one of our friends, Brian Rosemiles, when he was very depressed one day, heard from a student colleague, it's just the right people who are here for this gathering. And it's the right people because we want to, for the Ronning Center, do maybe four or five sessions around the theme, what has the liberal tradition, what's the strength of the liberal tradition, where is it at today in terms of its engagement with social issues. And so this is sort of a launching, and then I see some excellent volunteers sitting there, maybe just for brainstorming sessions. Sit down with David and me, we'll try to call some of you together, and then think, okay, well, how would we unfold this? I think this is a very important part of the Christian expression in this case, and then, okay, where is it at, and what is its strength, what is its contribution? We always try to, if we critique a tradition, we try to critique it from the depth of its own tradition, rather than from outside. And so if we see, you know, narrowness, as I say, in the liberal tradition, okay, then within the liberal tradition, from how could you critique? Of course you can critique starting points, that's another conversation. But so today, to launch us on this, we have Bob McKeon, you should pick up one of these programs after if you don't get the newsletter. But he had his PhD from the University of Toronto. He taught at Newman Theological College in Edmonton. His focus has been Catholic social teaching. He is currently the head of the Office of Social Justice in the Catholic Archdiocese of Edmonton, and also lectures at St. Joseph's College. And as you can see here, we have, according to David's interesting way of how his mind works, so we have a Roman Catholic, and a Lutheran, both here lumped together in a certain sense in the liberal tradition, right? So, which is good
after Benedict XVI.
Exactly, because in fact most of our traditions aren't denominational anymore. They go across denominations, and it means, what particular element of the faith is crucial to you, and then how do you put that into practice? So on the other hand, we have Martin Garber Conrad, and Martin and our family go back centuries.
Way back.
Yeah. Exactly. So when Martin was a wee little gaffer, just fresh out of Chicago, he did some youth work here in Western Canada, and in both in Alberta and British Columbia. He actually stayed with Pat and me for, was it half a year maybe, or?
Yeah, even before Karsten.
Yeah, even before Karsten was born. That's why Karsten didn't
come and greet him. The BK era.
Yeah. Anyhow, so Martin has not only been trained well in Chicago, but he's always put that understanding that faith has to be engaged in social action and into practice for the longest time of his career, aside from having a youth minister, then a ordained Lutheran minister. It was actually for the Edmonton City Center Corporation, so which deals with a whole variety of projects in downtown Edmonton. And he currently is the CEO, or what's the fancy language, of the Edmonton Community Foundation. So those are our two illustrious presenters, and take it away in any way you want.
Okay. Thank you. Bob was just suggesting that since there are so few of us, it might be worth going around the room and perhaps not your entire biography, but who you are and what you are. For a start, do you guys want to start?
Sure. My name is Ryan Mason, and I work here at Augustana, and I also do research on the social economy.
No kidding. Cool.
I'm Tiffany. And I work at Fiona's, and I am a pseudo student and a student chaplain.
And so why isn't Fiona's open today?
Yeah, we're doing some minor renovations. They'll be open again Saturday.
That's half the reason I come to Camrose. Anyway.
My name is Candace Trombley. I'm the sustainability coordinator here on campus. And work in the Learning Beyond Office of Social Economy Foundation.
Sustainability. I like that. That's very in. Yeah, in Matt.
Well, I'm Randall Nicol, currently executive director at the Camrose Open Door Association, and then have spent time with Mennonite Central Committee overseas and on their Canadian boards.
Cool.
I'm Dave Zantolos. I help people with early retirement, that sort of thing. I'm just interested in anything Camrose that do with commerce that
anywhere you go to. I do that very much. So
cool.
Barb Dansky. I'm an MTS student at St. Stephen's. Currently writing a paper on Christian ethics and its place in the public debate. And also my husband's involved in the project in the task and trying to bring a homeless shelter in. So this is interesting for them as well.
Christian ethics. Interesting idea.
Diane Chir, Professor Emeriti at the University of Alberta, and I guess I've been connected to many faith-based organizations. The newest one, I'm on the board of the Good Samaritan Society, which is faith-based as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And some standing, yes.
And
I'm Tom Kieran. I'm also a Professor Emeritus from the University of Alberta. And I'm on the board at Edmonton City Center Church Corporation.
Okay. Cool.
Oh, yes, I forgot one of the C's.
Which is relevant to today's conversation.
Yeah.
I'm Dave Stoley. I live in Camrose and I'm retired after spending my life in government and not-for-profit organizations, mostly in social service and community health.
Cool.
I'm Bob Papstein from Hay Lakes, retired teacher, and I'm on the board of Neighbor Aid here in Camrose.
Cool. Okay. The conversation that Bob and I want to have with you today is about the role of faith-based organizations in the social economy, but just in case the phrase social economy is not immediately familiar, and if it is, I'd be very surprised because it's not exactly on the tip of very many people's tongues.
Except for all of our students.
Excellent. That's just so commendable. And there is no universally agreed definition, but I think there's some kind of a broad sense of what it is, and it looks at the world through an economic lens and sees that there are at least three sectors, and the most common one that our society seems incredibly obsessed with is the business or private sector that tends to take over the entire meaning of economy. The second sector of the economy that's usually talked about is the public sector. In other words, that sector of the economy that is owned by the state. And the third sector in economy is often now being called the social economy, and that embraces a whole range of community and voluntary and not-for-profit activities and organizations. This whole notion of sector is very broad. It's not about a particular type of organization or even a governance model. It's not even about profit or not, although it does have something to do with what is done with those profits or surpluses or excesses. Just for your amusement, once you get to three sectors, then of course somebody decides there should be a fourth sector as well. And that's often talked about as the informal sector and deals primarily with activities and exchanges on the family level or sometimes family and friends. But any further beyond that at the neighborhood or community level, we're already into what's talked about as part of the social economy. In addition to sharing a whole lot of social justice work over more decades than we would probably be willing to admit to, Bob and I are part of a very interesting social economy research project that was funded by a 5-year SHRC grant, and in fact embraces the entire country, and we're part of a node of that larger project called BALTA, if you want to Google that sometime. And that's the BC in Alberta. I don't I think we lost the connection between actual words and the letters, but we're the BC Alberta group, and looking at a whole range of topics related to the social economy, the key feature of this research is that it quite explicitly and in reality involves both academics and practitioners. And many of us who are either neither of those or both of those or somewhere in between, but it's a very deliberate attempt to bring the expertise that academics working in the field have with the different but still significant expertise that actual practitioners on the ground doing the work in communities have. And I think, you know, it's been quite stimulating and interesting, and we all wear different hats and play different sides of the argument from time to time, but actually it's worked out surprisingly well. It's generated a few dozen projects, either completed or still in the works. One of these projects, the one that that Bob headed up, was specifically looking at the role of faith-based organizations in the social economy and kind of in Western Canada. And so as soon as I finish, Bob will take you through some of the findings from that sort of initial survey kind of paper that he and a couple of his students did, and perhaps also talk about the next step we see in that. And then I'll share a few brief anecdotes about a faith-based social economy organization that I worked with for a number of years, and a couple of kind of principles or issues that animated that. And then we hope there will be lots of questions and discussions and perhaps even some arguments and so forth. So take it away, Bob.
Okay. So we need to fire this up. Maybe we can get the...
No, everything's good. I just take these off.
Okay, and I should position myself so I'm not...
Right in the middle of it? Yeah.
Right. Well, your head is beautiful.
Yeah, you don't want to look at me the whole time. Good. And... Okay, so I can see... Good, what you're looking at. It's good to be here. It's good to be able to talk about this. I'm wearing two hats. One is I was introduced with various academic hoops I've jumped from through in my life, and different times of my life I've taught at different colleges and universities. But the other side of that is, and for what we're talking about today, is probably more relevant too. I come as a practitioner probably over about 30 years. I live in an inner city neighborhood in Edmonton. Been involved sometimes in leadership, sometimes not, around projects around housing, microloans, healthcare, just general community engagement in inner city neighborhoods. And the thing that really struck me in doing that was that in almost all these ventures, there were significant faith-based participants. Even if much of the work was not Christian or religious by name, inevitably they'd be significant players. So at a certain stage in my life, when there was actually some funding coming through and some research, I'd say, let's reflect on this experience. Let's see where we can take this. Okay, out of this project came a paper, and I'll work from it a bit. If this gets too boring and formal, we'll just shift off it, right? Mm-hmm. And talk. We know, okay, it's titled Faith-Based Organizations Engaged in the Social Economy in Western Canada. So we're looking at social economy organizations. We're looking at the role of faith-based organizations involved in that. We know that, first, social economy organizations have been part of Canadian history, Canadian community economic development for generations, and really in every part of the country, right?
Is this work?
Yeah, okay.
So we know where that comes from.
I mean, we can think of the Antigonish movement in Nova Scotia, right? Really influential. And there's offshoots coming out here. Think of the Desjardins movement in Quebec. Whole series co-op credit unions as you go through Ontario. And, of course, in the West, you know, I just drove down the highway here and the gas station turn off. I have a choice between co-op and UFA, right? it's hard to get away from. You know, the grain pools, credit unions, and it's really been part of our life in the West. And again, while most of them, but not all, may not be explicitly faith-based, inevitably there's important faith-based leaders and participants. And even you look at something as big as Service Credit Union, that now I think argues they have 400,000 members or something, some gargantuan figure, go to their website, trace it back. Their founding is from a place called Mangan Credit Union, which is the basement of St. Alphonsus Catholic Church in 118th Ave. Everybody's forgotten the history. Now they're, you know, a Royal Bank wannabe almost. But, I mean, that's where it started, right? Working class neighborhood, local church, how do we support ourselves? Very grassroots economic development. Much of what we looked at, and of course Canadian history, is around Christian involvement. But we know increasingly, and it's worth further study to look at the role of other world religions, and of course Aboriginal spirituality around community economic initiatives. We know the Christian churches have developed explicit formal teaching about economic justice, human rights, participation in the community. And we have more formal teachings. The denomination I work for has Catholic social teaching, a whole series of formal documents. And I even gave you a handout with the most recent Vatican document that supports social economy. But World Council of Churches. And interestingly, I found that when Dietmar introduced our session, spoke of liberal tradition. It's interesting on the community economic development initiatives, it goes way beyond what we could historically call the liberal churches. Many of the evangelical churches in the States are really key players and have brought, you know, some literature and have given you a bibliography that tracks some of that. And even Catholic social teaching, there's some very conservative theological people that would be appalled at being called liberal, who would very much invest themselves in this type of venture. We know in Canada, many of our Christian churches individually and collectively have spoken publicly about economic justice concerns repeatedly over the decades. We can see this in the leadership statements of, say, the Canadian Catholic Bishops, the United Church of Canada, and many other religious groups. And in the last 40 years, we've seen several Canadian churches develop a working consensus on economic justice concerns and have built economic organizations and coalitions to work together. Often out of this collaboration has come social economy support. Today, you could look at, say, the Kairos Coalition, and economic justice remains a key focus on that. One of the main commentators on this in Canada is a Catholic theologian, but very ecumenical sense, Gregory Baum. And he quotes one of the statements of the Canadian bishops, saying, many people clearly see today's dominant ideologies, whether capitalism or Marxism, contradict gospel values. We have a search for new social values, goals, structures as a mark of our times. In these events, God calls us to break out of inadequate patterns of thinking and acting, to live new lives, join all men and women in building a new society with his real freedom based on love and justice. So how do you live that out? Well, one of the ways many look at it is saying, can we build a human-friendly economy? You'll find Pope Benedict call it civilizing the economy, or building an economy of communion. Now, you get all the theological words, but you see what he's drifting at, or trying to work at there, right? Baum and others see the search for new social values and goals and structures moving in the direction of the social economy. They see the social economy approach better encompassing Catholic social teaching values, such as solidarity, respect for the dignity of human work, concern for the common good, and a preferential concern for the poor other than poor in other economic models. Good. And or just think of the United Church when Bill Phipps was moderator. He did the Faith in the Common Good Project, right? Moral economy. And if you go through that documentation, social economy is really emphasized. So this crosses a lot of our boundaries. We have a rich literature emerging, developing on the engagement of churches in the social economy. And I guess this is the academic side of me. I filled my suitcase full of books, so and I gave you a bibliography. One of the largest is Mondragon in Spain, right? Co-op of series of co-ops, tens of thousands of employees. It starts 4 or 5 unemployed young men talking to the local Catholic pastor in the Basque region. How do we get started? They start a small stove company, which leads to appliances, which leads to funding, education, research. And now actually from some of the people that are really keen in this social economy, say in Nova Scotia, they do regular tours to Mondragon. To learn more about how to build their own tradition. We have a recent book in Canada about 10 years ago, an Anglican, Mary McAdam, provided a study on the engagement of Canadian churches and religious groups in community economic development, and it's full of Canadian case studies. He entitles that From Corporate Greed to Common Good. Okay, so you can get a sense where he's coming from. Several Christian writers in the United States, such as Jim Wallace with Sojourners, Tony Campolo from a more ecumenical side, John Perkins from a more black evangelical side, support social economy approaches as a model for Christian social ministry. And there's even a whole series of how-to guidebooks, and I brought a few with me, coming out of the U.S., for churches wanting to get more involved. For example, World Vision has published books around job creation and housing. Alban Institute, which is sort of the main pastoral press, again speaks of different models of community social economy engagement. What we did in this project was really modest goals. We wanted to identify faith-based organizations in social economy in Alberta. We didn't have the resources or the time to try to track down everybody. We just tried to do an initial kind of mapping. We wanted to explore the different ways that faith FBOs are participating. What kind of involvements? What kind of areas? The different types of FBO engaged. And to the extent, at least we could start, how does faith influence FBO engagement in the social economy? BALTA is doing a broader social economy mapping, and what we tried to do was really piggyback on that. We compiled a list of about 60 FBOs to start, you know, the research steps, a working bibliography, a long list of groups to look at, a workable short list, a first round of interviews, then a second round of more intensive interviews, and then tried to write things up. So we started with 60. We did interviews with 37. Only one declined to talk to us. And inevitably, some things get lost in the communication. And we did 13 second round interviews that were in much greater detail. And we ran out of money and time, and that's as far as we got this time. So and that gives you a rough sense of the geographic background. You'll obviously see biases more urban than rural. Obviously the rural, and probably a place like Camrose and the work Karsten does is worth, you know, following up in greater detail. But that gives you a sense of the groups we talked to. So the first question. Two basic approaches. One is faith-based organizations. They're religious in nature, even likely in their name. So we've already named, like, Edmonton City Centre Church Corporation. Well, by the very name, there's a faith identity to it. But the other side we see is often faith organizations collaborating in broader community initiatives. I was involved for years with a group called Edmonton Inner City Housing Society. That's now quite big. At key points, say religious orders were crucial to its success, but it's a community organization. It's not a religious organization. Yet in the very visioning, values, foundational bases, the religious influences in terms of being a foundation the organization could work from are quite significant. So a couple of examples here. What are some of these partnerships where the faith identity isn't necessarily visible? We do an annual financial fundraising around called No Room in the Inn. Now that has a religious name, but there's secular partners there. We're in the churches every year. Money's raised to support specific social economy housing initiatives. I live in a housing cooperative whose mortgages come from a very unconventional lender, the Canadian Altered Investment Cooperative, based in Toronto. Couple dozen religious orders have accumulated approximately $7 million in loan capital, and rather give to the Royal Bank to maximize their return, which these days may not happen, they decided to invest in specifically social economy investments, either through loans or other means of financial support, but not grants. So, and it starts the religious orders, but now it has non-religious partners, and again, it's Canadian Alternate Investment Cooperative, so it's a social economy player of significant influence and size. Another could be a group we've developed in Edmonton that's still very much underway, the Greater Edmonton Alliance, a broad-based community organization.
We get a couple of slides behind.
Thank you. No, actually, I'm not.
No? Oh, okay, because you're referring to you. Okay.
I'll get there. Okay. I'm just talking some of the partnerships now. Mm-hmm. Greater Edmonton Alliance is in the process of creating a social economy organization called Sustainable Works, and I've given you a description of that, which will be a nonprofit group partnering with labor unions, churches, and other groups, environmental groups, to do retrofit on houses for energy efficiency. Triple bottom line, lower cost for housing, job creation, job training, especially through apprenticeship programs with unions, and three bottom lines. They're going to make money. So there'll be money there. Okay, let's move on. Whoops, can I go backwards on it?
No. Yes, just previous.
Okay. So what do FBOs do in the social economy? The funders. And that could be at the level of grants. They could be lenders. For example, CAKE doing mortgages. They can be housing organizations. Provide housing services long term. Build houses, operate houses. Different models even. From rental, rent-to-own, and so on. Retail sales and delivery of services. Employment and job training. So those were the five areas that we identified in our survey, and we found groups working in each of those areas. So if you look at funders, I mean, one I initially introduced here, No Room in the Inn. 13 Christian denominations, an annual fund directly to support social economy housing initiatives, nonprofit initiatives in the Edmonton region. This year was part of the Housing First Homeless project with Inner City Housing. Last year it was a transition house for E4C on at-risk women leaving the street. There's the Canadian Alternate Investment Cooperative, a lender. The second model here, in operation over 25 years, raised several million dollars in loan capital. It's a national fund, has operated in various provinces, and you have examples of some of the groups that have been funded through that. Interesting, another lender, don't have a slide for this, Jubilee Fund in Manitoba. ecumenical Christian organization started in the year 2000. Winnipeg-based expression of the Millennium Celebration. Remember the year 2000? The great Christian celebration. Looking back to the Jubilee year. It's about debt. It's about social transformation. Not just anniversary celebration. So they felt, let's make a significant move in that direction. The Jubilee Fund was started in the hopes of restoring equity in society. Their investments are geared towards greater self-reliance, self-respect, dignity, improved quality of life for its communities. They've raised funds through a variety of ways, including memberships, fundraising events, grants from the Manitoba government, the Winnipeg Foundation, and people investing their own monies in just promissory notes or investment certificates, individuals. It actively is working to achieve its goal of living in a world in which equitable economic opportunities are available to all members of society. They offer loan guarantees to worthy individuals, community projects, business projects, housing projects, and so on. Jubilee Fund has been in existence for 9 years, has a broad ecumenical base of support. They're now looking to expand to include other faith traditions, becoming multi-faith, and we'll see that's a trend. Retail sales. Faith organizations have formed social economy organizations that sell goods and services. One approach is to meet important community needs for goods and services in a fair, affordable way. In Edmonton, we have Serenity Funeral Services. You can be buried through a social economy organization. One example, Serenity is one example of this approach. Another approach is fair trade products. Probably most of us connected with churches, sometime in our church basement, we've bought fair trade coffee, right? Bought and sold. We've been doing that at least 25 years. It's almost become a parallel sacrament that we do upstairs and downstairs in our church buildings, right? One of the leaders here is obviously 10,000 Villages, right? A group coming out of the Mennonite community. Not-for-profit business. Traces its origins back over 60 years ago. 10,000 Villages, a quote from Gandhi, right? We're probably fairly familiar with that, but it's an attempt based on fair trade, an attempt to get in touch with the artisans directly or producer co-ops to build an equitable, a fair trade relationship with these primary producers, different parts of the world. And this employs people, provides payment to people who might otherwise be unemployed or underemployed, and in many cases the work can create sustainable microeconomies in their villages. The Mennonite Central Committee, through 10,000 Villages, does not seek to proselytize in the countries with its social economy projects, including 10,000 Villages. We have housing models, and one model we looked at in some detail was More Than a Roof in British Columbia. Initially starting as a Mennonite housing society, Christian nonprofit, started by the Mennonite Central Committee of British Columbia in 1984, starts from an initial 26 unit facility, and now has several projects, five communities housing over 1,000 people. They seek to be more than a social housing provider, also has an advocacy role for clients. They've moved eventually to a different form of incorporation, and now it's at arm's length from the Mennonite community. An Alberta group, much smaller, called the Champion Society. I don't have a slide for that. Starts out of Pinoca. An individual and his wife buy a piece of property. They soon learn about the housing shortage, particularly those suffering from mental illness. Rooted in his Christian faith, he invites others to join him to incorporate the Champion Center as a nonprofit society. Now has three locations and trying to get a fourth project going in Edmonton. This is very volunteer, very small scale, very grassroots, with at this to this point very little government money involved. Employment, and Martin will talk more on this. Several of the FBOs do social economy work around job creation and job training. Certainly the Kids in the Hall program in Edmonton, if you go to City Hall, go to the restaurant. At one level, it looks like a conventional restaurant. At another level, it's a rather unconventional place, and Martin will give us more detail on that. What was the not the euphemism, but the phrase we used for, we're not going to talk of youth at risk, right?
Youth of promise.
Youth of promise. So Kids in the Hall engages Youth of Promise, an innovative job training program. We'll have to get this slide corrected here. The training program includes life skills, practical job skills, and on-the-job training. In Vancouver, there's a Just Work Economic Initiative by the Grandview Calvary Baptist Church. Identified employment as a key concern. They set up three different types of enterprises: Just Work Landscaping, Just Work Catering, and Just Work Pottery. Again, small outfits, but specifically to get jobs, right? To bring money into people who can use it, to move beyond the charity model. One of the questions we asked, okay, we call it faith-based. Well, what's the faith organization that's involved? And this can take very different forms. Sometimes it comes out of a local congregation, and what's now a huge operation, but Mustard Seed in Calgary comes out of a specific Baptist church. They could be non-congregational faith organizations. CAKE, coming out of the religious orders in the Catholic Church, or 10,000 Villages, a different type of Mennonite organization, Mennonite Central Committee, that's organized in a way different than congregations are. Sometimes we have ecumenical or interfaith coalitions. For example, No Room in the Inn, and you can see the partners there. And sometimes it's a group of simply individuals who come together and say, we want to work out of our values, let's get something started. And they may be from one faith tradition or from multiple faith traditions. We mentioned on the local congregations, certainly Mustard Seed in Calgary is a really clear example, and now they have multiple locations. A very interesting project in Edmonton was done by a United Church right close to the Alberta University of Alberta Hospital, Garneau United Church. A church going back to the 1920s, but faced with an aging and waning congregational membership, they needed to make decisions about their future. So they reinvented themselves in an interesting way. They knocked down their church building and built a high-rise on the site. Really a long-term continuing care facility. The ground floor has room for the church to meet. Their primary asset to a social economy conversation was their land. They still needed land in order to continue a worship space, but it was zoned in an area where you could go to high density, so take full value of the land, bring partners in, and create a valuable social economy enterprise, even in physical co-partnership with the church itself, because even today they're all in the same building. The non-congregational faith organizations, certainly one on the Catholic side is St. Vincent de Paul Society, which, like in Victoria, runs housing initiatives or job creation initiatives. It's a part of an international lay organization, primarily known for their face-to-face charity. But out of that leads to other forms of social economy participation. Certainly the Mennonite Central Committee is a long-standing successful model of bringing people of faith background into social economy work. We've mentioned the interfaith coalitions, for example, No Room in the Inn. The Faithful Individuals, we mentioned the Champions Center, but maybe we could speak of a quite different approach, Servants Anonymous in Calgary. Interesting history. 20 years ago, three people from Christian faith backgrounds met weekly for Bible study. One day, one of the women was on her way to their weekly meeting, encountered a prostitute on the street, invited her into her home. Others soon followed and moved in, led to the incorporation of Servants Anonymous Society. Residential buildings were obtained, support services, including counseling, employment training. This individual leader approach for FBOs has been repeated many times in communities across Western Canada. Simply individuals getting interested, individual reaching out, organizing, becoming more complex, incorporating, funding, and so on. How is faith expressed in faith-based organizations? Okay, there's the Servants Anonymous slide there. Different ways. Again, you say faith-based organization, you may think it's all very similar. It's not. The faith part may be primarily in the history of the organization. It's a tradition. It's how it got started. It's how its founding stories are told. It may lie primarily in the inspiration, mystery, mission, and value of the organization. So it's still part of the mission, still part of the value. There may be explicit faith support from faith sources. Another level could be, if you're to be a board member, you're to have a faith identity. And that's where it's captured. Others go further and say, if you're going to work for the outfit, you need a faith identity. And you could go further, you could find examples where the faith influences the very service and program delivery. And we found organizations really at all seven levels. And even as the questions were answered on this, it was done in quite different ways. Let me just give an example or two here. One example that primarily is sort of at the high end, the history, inspiration, mission, and value, would be an organization like Jewish Family Services in Edmonton. The executive director, as we interviewed him, was hesitant even to call it an FBO, although Jewish values, belief, and principles were said to be the guiding principles of the organization. The executive director was a good United Churchman. Jewish Family Services. So it's has a history and inspiration, but you don't have to be Jewish to work for the outfit. Mustard Seed in Calgary takes a different position, expecting a clear Christian faith commitment from its staff when one signs a paper, when one works there. Some of the FBOs at the level of service delivery invite their clients to religious events, such as Bible studies or worship services. But none in the study made it a requirement for housing, food, employment, training, or other services. At that point of making the quid pro quo, you show religious participation and you get the service. None were at that level. Some of us may have heard the recent kind of reports, and it was on the CBC morning show yesterday, an organization in Calgary reaching out to youth seeking government money. And the question of evangelization arose. The groups we interviewed did not seek to come to really force together the faith evangelization and the social economy work. Although, for example, in housing, there could be chaplaincy and the residents be invited, but it not be a requirement. Whoops. Okay. I want to go back again.
Scroll back if you want. This
okay. I can just...
Yeah, either way. One more.
Okay. I'm coming to a close. This part, we'll get into more interesting pretty quickly. Changes over time. Are there any trends? We observed three. Some faith-based organizations founded with partners from within one denominational tradition over time invite new partners from other denominational traditions. The example of Canadian Alternate Investment Cooperative starts primarily with Catholic nuns. At a later time, you'll see the United Church as a key partner. So once they kind of get into it and get it going, saying, well, why keep the participants restricted? Open it up. Some FBOs with a Christian ecumenical faith identity saw that an expansion of their scope should include other faith traditions and become multi-faith instead of Christian ecumenical. And the Jubilee Fund in Winnipeg was a clear example. Some clearly become more secular over time. They start as an explicit FBO, and over time, their faith orientation is primarily in the history and founding story, but not active now. And there's one prominent FBO. Well, this is, I mean, we can name this Edmonton City Center Church Corporation, right, in their new rebranding, would no longer use church. They name 4Cs compassion, caring, and so on. So it's being less explicit in their faith identity. Oops. You can tell how old I am by my familiarity with the technology. We also asked the question, does the faith identity help or hinder the work of the FBOs being social economy actors? We had several FBOs say it really helps. helps us recruit people, helps keeps us focused, gives us energy, gives us a common purpose. It really helps. Couple examples that it creates problems. If you're involved in an economic enterprise, maybe you're trying to get corporate partners, and you say, we really don't support religious outfits. So it creates obstacles. But that was a minority of responses. And others responded and said, well, it doesn't really make that much difference one way or the other. That's who we are, and we do our work, but it doesn't really hinder us, and we don't see it as particularly giving us an advantage. Coming to a conclusion, we looked at other directions for further research. We're going to do a second phase on this, and we'll start this summer. We saw two faith traditions that were successful in a variety of settings, in a variety of enterprises, repeatedly, regardless of the geography. And these were particularly the involvement of the Catholic religious orders, especially the women, the Catholic nuns, and the Mennonite initiatives, often focused around the Mennonite Central Committee. And these were interesting, because clearly you could see the faith grounding. Yet, it was done in a way that invited others, that made partnerships possible. So there's something really interesting in both of them. And of course, Mennonite theology and Catholic theology cannot be equated. They're distinct traditions. Yet, when they work in this area of social economy, really interesting things happen consistently. So we felt, let's dig deeper within those two traditions and try to get a sense of the success of bringing faith grounding and advancing this kind of work. There's something really interesting there. I wonder if we could label it, maybe crudely put, maybe we could bottle it, replicate it, and take it much further. Greater focus on FBOs associated with other religious faith traditions, in addition to Christianity. For example, we have a whole new start of, say, Aboriginal organizations, certainly in Edmonton's inner city, and I dare say in major cities in Western Canada. Successful Aboriginal work has a spiritual dimension, and we know that. When we simply say faith-based organizations and identify churches, congregations, when we talk in Aboriginal involvement, we need different language, different perspectives. Can we get a sense of that? Realizing, as we're learning, a grounded spirituality can facilitate this kind of social economy engagement. What more can we learn there? Greater emphasis on FBOs in rural communities, and maybe take some of the key ones and really do much more intensive case studies so you really get a sense how they work and how that goes further. The hope coming out of this project long term is really two things. One is to go to the wider social economy community and ask and invite them to say, can you see your local faith organizations as potential partners, particularly where that's not there? And we can see examples where we do see a lot of social economy involvement, the faith community is absent. There's a resource missing. So to show models to encourage non-faith social economy practitioners to see faith communities as potential partners. And the other, which is sort of my day job now that I work for the Catholic Diocese and community outreach, is to go to the faith communities and say, okay, you're doing soup kitchens, you're doing this. Can you begin to see the social economy as a way of really grounding your values in long-term sustainable operations that are more empowering, or that, not either or, but that can build on a lot of the face-to-face charity work that's already in place. So they begin to go back to the faith organizations and say, can you begin to commit more serious resources? Can you begin to see this more as your community outreach, a way of living out your faith? So both sides, to animate the non-faith social economy community and the social economy community. Okay, I'm done. Let's get to some of the interesting stories that Martin can present.
Just let me highlight a couple of they're not exactly principles, but values or ideas that animated the work I did over about 20 years with City Center Church Corporation. The beginnings of that organization were certainly in the broadly understood liberal tradition. It came out of the late 60s thing where the ecumenical movement, which had actually started somewhat before that, but it finally got to Edmonton. And you know, an Anglican priest was allowed to have lunch with a United Church minister or even a Lutheran. That was not the norm before that. And so was this sort of mainstream Protestant group that started it and very early on invited the Catholic, a downtown Catholic parish to join. In the early days, there was even the interfaith outreach to the rabbi at the local synagogue, although that proved to be going a little too far, and the Christians decided they wanted to keep this kind of a Christian thing. Certainly by the time I came, the work had shifted from the first couple of years where it had a very downtown focus, and they were talking about things like Bible studies for workers in high-rise offices, outreach to people living in apartment buildings. That was sort of about the time that apartment buildings started in Edmonton. And perhaps things like city chaplaincy or police chaplaincy. By the early 70s, it was clear that the need was not so much downtown as it was inner city. And so already by the time I came in the middle 80s, the work was focused on those most in need, primarily through a homeless women's shelter and a snack program for inner city kids. So without the well-developed social justice theology that our Catholic friends had, although that wasn't always very obvious at the cathedral parish, and was probably a minority position even in the downtown United Church, but that vague sense of social justice was animating, and that reaching out to the poor and less fortunate. During my time there were two principles that animated my work and my thinking that very much came out of my religious tradition. And the words I put around that were hospitality and forgiveness. And without making that explicit, except on very rare occasions, I saw the connections, at least in my own mind, and between what we're trying to do, providing homes for people who didn't have a home, providing shelter for women who otherwise had to live on the street, providing food for hungry children. That sense of hospitality and the forgiveness was also very important, because when you get into particularly the housing work, the mainstream pressure is to, if somebody screws up, you boot them out. Okay, that notion of second chances and openness and even the possibility that somebody might need housing for more than 3 months, or that somebody might need sheltering for more than 3 weeks. These were incredibly real issues where, whether it was the government or the public, seemed to have this notion that it was okay to help people, but not too much. You know, they might become dependent on you, or they need to, they need to work out their own salvation sufficiently to be worthy of your grace, which I always thought was the Lutheran position in Western Canada. So those were some of the animating principles, and never explicit. Actually, from the very beginning, and I think. And Bob, certainly, I mean, you found lots of other models, but one of the things that made E4C work was driven by the vision of this incredible Baptist lawyer who, he didn't found the organization, but he developed the documents and kind of the corporate culture for this organization. And from almost day one, certainly long before I came, everybody was assumed to have significant religious motivation for wanting to be involved in this work, like to be on the board and stuff. But you left your religious stuff at the door when you came around the board table at E4C. It was about getting the work done. And therefore, although there was certainly increasing openness over the years between the various denominations, it almost never got played out around the board table. So we didn't have to argue about biblical inerrancy or women in the clergy or social justice versus evangelization. We didn't have to do any of that. You could play that at home if you wanted to, or outside and all that. But it was about getting the work done. So in a sense, it was a deliberate setting aside of our particular denominational traditions so that that didn't interfere with helping the people that we shared a belief in that God loved. And I certainly agree with that penultimate slide of Bob's about the faith background helps, the faith background doesn't help, and the faith background both helps and doesn't help. I mean, there's dozens of experiences of that all in the same organization. I saw and worked on having that notion of hospitality and forgiveness animate much of what we did through a number of years, and that led us into some very interesting work. Toward the end of my regime, we actually strayed briefly back into more religious work when we took on an Anglican priest who was doing a prison ministry. She was appointed as chaplain to the new women's prison. And again, she was very open and very ecumenical and had, you know, essentially a government or quasi-governmental appointment. But we were able to host this tiny little program and give her an organizational home. But, you know, over a period of 20 years, that was about the only explicitly religious thing that the organization ever did. The final thing I'd like to say is to draw you back to Benedict XVI and the Caritas in Veritate, which I haven't read the whole thing, but the line that I like best is an economy of gratuitousness. And just that simple phrase is going to inspire me to dig out this whole thing and read it. I think that's a very exciting concept and certainly fits well within the liberal Protestant tradition. I think it fits well within the broad Christian tradition, and I expect it would find some resonance in many of the other, there aren't many, but in the other monotheistic faiths. So I would leave that notion of the economy of gratuitousness with you. And that's all I want to say. So, do you guys want to talk about this stuff? Is any of this interesting? Do you? I think some of you may have your own experiences to share, but yeah. At a conceptual level, is any of this, does it make sense? Does it not make sense?
Should churches be doing stuff like this? Is social economy a promising way to the our goals?
I mean, again, my experience, there's a whole host of books, and Bob's very, very much in touch with I mean, there are literally dozens of writers and bits of coming out of social justice or now the environment is usually thrown into the social sphere. But certainly my experience to this day, this is still very much a marginal little niche in the Christian church and in any faith community as far as I know. And it's, you know, there was a period, sort of that period where there was a lot of writing about social justice and whatever it was called in the Catholic Church, and there was, you know, even some brief publicity, but boy, I can tell you this is really marginal work, and for the most part, people with little or no faith tradition background or current commitments have certainly put the Christian community to shame. And this notion of social justice or even frankly of grace or gratuitousness. And that hurts me as someone who used to see himself as part of the One Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church and from a theological tradition that said that grace was the most important thing. All this work is very marginalized. I think the exciting thing that Bob keeps reminding me of is that, yeah, well, it may be marginalized, but it's still out there, and it's out there in many, many forms, and it lives on even when it's no longer explicitly connected to the church. And so that's definitely a sign of hope.
I didn't quite understand you there, Martin. Could you elaborate on how do you see people that have no connection to faith traditions doing this work?
You know, I meant doing the social economy work. Philosophically, I think when I started this work, many of them came out of a vaguely Marxist kind of justice, solidarity with the poor that had no particular Christian faith content. Bob is certainly, and we do this often in our own community in terms of tracing no longer explicit or lost in the mists of history faith connections with various community organizations, but even at that, it's, you know, maybe a tenth or a hundredth, or maybe it's a quarter in some neighborhoods of community development, social justice, social economy, service to the poor. A relatively small proportion of those organizations had an explicit faith connection and still do. And of course, as my generation ages, I mean, I grew up working with people who had left the church because they felt such disgust toward it. But most of the people I meet now have not left the church because they were never in it to begin with. And so, you know, they're not rebelling or saying, you know, we're tired of your useless theological debates. We just want to help the poor. Well, they were never in it. There was nothing for them to leave. And, I mean, that's hopeful, too, because God's will be done. If not through us, then in other ways. I'm just, the larger the social economy is much larger than faith-based organizations, but I think it's also helpful to remember that many organizations did have this faith commitment, and I think for anybody who still values and believes in and is committed to the church, at least in its earthly semi-organized form, to be reminded that some good and interesting work has been done in this way and therefore could be done again.
Is part of what you were driving at the I don't know if it's the case or not, but I'll say it, the tendency of people within the church to not care about the social economy as it's expressed through the public governmental institutions. I mean, is part of it this sort of political backdrop of,
for sure,
people want to choose religious organizations because they don't want to support public organizations?
No, I think it's much worse than that. Actually, I think most of mainstream Protestantism is bought into corporate capitalism, and the most faithful people have this little compartment that they keep their faith in, but rarely let it stray out to affect their dealings with the private sector, which dealings are primarily economical. They rarely let it out to influence their political, in other words, their dealings with the state economy. I think that's incredibly the majority position in the States, and I fear where the Christian church is disproportionately associated with the right wing of the Republican Party. I think it's very often the case in Canada and particularly in Western Canada, as the church has become suburbanized and as we've all become more committedly middle class, among the most faithful Christians, any interest in the social economy is definitely a minority position.
We got a question, Ben, you all the way in the back first. No,
would it be fair to say that these organizations are small, marginal, and highly efficient? If we give charity money to them, most of it reaches people.
Well, I would suggest that that's the case with most charities. I think it would, one could certainly assert that about faith-based organizations, but I think it would be very difficult. I don't think there's any actual evidence to show that, in other words, that faith-based organizations are disproportionately efficient or effective compared to non. I know some incredibly efficient and effective community organizations that have no explicit connections with faith groups and that I would quite confidently give money to. And I know faith-based organizations that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, and in fact, on occasion, would try to discourage other people from supporting them because I think they're, well, not to put too fine a point on it, evil. I think overall, most of the charitable nonprofit community sector, whatever you want to call it, it is in fact both more efficient and more effective than either of the other two sectors when it comes to actually helping people.
We had this conversation in Muslim circles in the United States, which I was familiar with, and I asked the question, does paying Social Security in the United States count as zakat?
Right.
And the answer was, it's so inefficient from our point of view. It doesn't reach down. The government is taking it and spending it on other governments. It's not charity anymore.
Right. Well, that's often the excuse for why Canadian charitable giving is lower than American charitable giving, because, well, Canadian taxes are so much higher, you know, we don't have as much money left over to give to charity, or, well, the government does most of charity anyway, so we don't need, you know, so we can afford the, you know, the average charitable giving in Canada is what, like $200 or $300 a year. I mean, it's only $500 or $600 in the States, but it's, you know, double. And likewise, corporate giving is equally miserly in Canada compared even to what it is in the States. So
it's grown there.
And I mean, even if you throw that all in, the notion of tithing as, you know, from a Christian perspective, that's been abandoned at the 99th percentile level as even something to be considered. I mean, anybody who tithes is just really weird. And anybody who discusses it is, you know, antisocial or just looking for trouble.
Okay.
I just wonder, are any of these faith-based organizations self-sustaining? And then if they are, how does that help the full-time economy, right? And then,
yeah.
Like, let's say you help that person pass through a three-month period, so you help for 6 months, even a year. Do they go on to become a better contributor to society, or do they stay in that state of unease? I mean,
yeah.
When you draw the line, you know, if they do get out help, that's great, but does that offset all the effort you put into helping them?
Yeah, and
everybody's important.
I mean, my experience with working with people kind of near the bottom is that with appropriate opportunities, many of them do get better, increase their skills, become more integrated into society, and eventually are able to look after themselves as much as any of us look after ourselves. Some not. On the other hand, there are people who stay in hospitals for months because they're sick. Or all of us one day, if we're lucky, will be in a long-term care facility. Now, does that mean are we lazy or deficient in character or not trying simply because, you know, we're paralyzed and we can't get up and walk? So I think most people want to be a part of the community, and it's important to try to find ways to make that happen. Some people maybe don't or can't, but my experience is that most people want to. My experience is that almost all hungry children want to eat, and none of them chose to be hungry.
Absolutely.
None of them chose to have bad parents. So it's not that there's no such thing as personal responsibility, but if we want better outcomes for society as a whole, for the community, we need to find ways to overcome a whole bunch of barriers. And at least one of the barriers we need to overcome is kind of our attitude toward anybody who's different, and particularly for people who are incapable or not particularly interested in buying into the dominant sort of norm, which is we will all succeed, we will get good jobs, we will buy expensive homes, we will have three cars, you know, we will have a bunch of kids, and they will have an even bigger house than we did. And this sort of rising,
yeah,
you know, that's the mainstream vision, this economic, it's not unrelated to the whole notion of economic growth.
But the question is, are you looking to create long-term care facilities that are currently reliant on charity, or are you trying to establish self-sustaining economies? Right. Now, obviously, there's always going to be one or two that fall through the cracks.
No, I think the best thing is to find ways for people to become part of the community and participate both socially and economically, well, and educationally and all sorts of things.
Have these organizations done this, the ones you've studied?
Yeah, they've certainly helped individuals.
But the organizations themselves are.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean,
it creates jobs, it creates new people, it creates its own economy, right? It pays some guy's mortgage to help his kids go to college.
For sure. The piece of the social economy that's better known are the 80-some thousand registered charities in Canada and the broader nonprofit sector, which includes nonprofit organizations that aren't charities, and there's, I don't know, 160 some of them. But just in that sector, we're looking at a significant portion of the mainstream economy in terms of you know, more than a million employees. Another million FTEs as a result of volunteer work. 80 or 90 billion dollars in revenue and expenditures every year, about the same amount in hard assets. This particular piece of the social economy is larger than the agriculture industry, larger than the construction industry, larger than the transportation industry, larger than the resource extraction industry. Okay, so it's a player in terms of secondary economic generation and just straight employment. The usual figure, I think, is something like 6.3% of the GDP, and that's, you know, that's just the hard stuff that can be quantified. So it's an important player in the larger economy, and then of course our faith-based organizations is a little, but not insignificant.
But isn't the category itself social economy an attempt to overcome our colleagues' way of framing this? I mean, have I understood this correctly? That is, if you start speaking in the language of sustainable, you're participating in, am I right about this? You're participating in a very particular kind of understanding of economy, which is not what the fundamental category here, I think, is trying to challenge a little bit. Am I right about that? Have I understood?
Yeah, well, that whole notion of sustainability has a lot of
it's like
currency.
The banks in America. They are right. Sustainable, right? And yeah. So is Ford, and so is GM, and so are all these corporations sustainable.
Yeah, no.
But that's, you know, that's a really particular vision of what sustainable
for
means.
Sure.
It depends on plus, who's got the big pockets.
Plus multi-trillion-dollar bailout.
That's my point. But my point is that we have not looked at those things. We have not considered what that means in terms of the narrow way of framing economy. I thought that the whole notion of social economy here is an attempt to say, as you began, there are at least three or four different ways of looking at this matter.
Yeah. So, and maybe to just come back on your point, are they sustainable? A lot's going to depend on what you try to do. We could look at housing organizations, and some we studied that are. There's no, and say one test would be is the continuing government money coming in or charity money. No. You build it right, you live on the money you make, and so on. But say you're running kids in the hall, and you keep hiring at-risk teenagers. You have to hire social workers, life skill coaches. It's going to make your restaurant, on a very narrow bottom line, unprofitable. But you're achieving multiple goals. So is it sustainable? Yes and no. So, I mean, a lot, or if you're going to take really at-risk people in housing.
The nonprofit sector as a whole gets a significant portion of its income already from self-generated revenue. We think of nonprofits existing either entirely on donations or on government grants. Those are the three main sources of income, but individual donations is the smallest, and in Alberta, self-generated revenue is the largest, and then government contracts, which I can assure you is far from charity. In fact, it's very difficult and expensive money to get. But that whole notion of sustainability and what we mean by it, it is in principle very difficult to sustain yourself in the strictly economic terms when the product or service that you deliver is explicitly designed for people who have no money. Okay?
Yeah, but that person off of the dole, so to speak, and it's still paying for itself, right? Because now that person no longer being a drain on society.
Yeah, for sure.
Plus, they have not had a better life. Which is the point. So the callous. I want people to have.
Yeah, no, and we want that for people, but it's interesting too. Our notions of the dole and welfare and how we attach that to individuals, but we rarely call a corporate welfare welfare, and wonder, you know, how many more decades is it going to take GM to get off corporate welfare. We don't find that quite as distasteful as the abused Aboriginal person who only completed grade 6, not being able to get a job in, you know, the information economy.
Some of us find that just as distasteful. There's just nothing we can do with that either, so.
Yeah.
We're going to go short on time before too long, but are there other questions or other participants?
Yeah.
I'd be interested in your comments on the extent to which the survival and growth of the social economy is in fact dependent on government grants. Seems to me government is preoccupied with keeping its employee count down. They're happy to find an organization that will provide the services at less than the union wages. And to some extent, government, not making an argument, but looking for a reaction, is exploiting the social economy to do the things that the public thinks the public is responsible for.
Yeah, and when I was running an organization like that, I wished they would exploit us more because that allowed us to grow.
But then it is growing by government exploitation, not from the convictions of the.
Rarely are things that pure and straightforward. There are always multiple reasons for doing things, and if I could be in charge, it would be much more straightforward and pure. But we got to make compromises all the time, and you know, the best I could do with the women's shelter was refuse to kick the women out after 3 weeks. You know, that was the norm in the industry, was 3 weeks, and then you boot them out. Well, a week after that, they'd be homeless again, and you could let them come back in. Well, no, 14 times during the year, you have to throw them out on the street and scream up, well, we refuse to do that. And it didn't work very well with the funding model, but, you know, there were some compromises that my faith and our organization's faith discouraged us from making. There's a lot of stuff that's distasteful and underfunded, and you got to give it away, and you got to get. The thing that I find most. One of the things that's most difficult about working in the social economy sector is that you gotta underpay people, and therefore you need to put what should be a societal burden on the specific individuals that actually care enough to do the work.
Maybe one way to answer your question is to shift it a bit and say not government money, yes or no. But what do appropriate partnerships look like? As much of what we want to do, if we simply say a rule at the beginning, there'll be no government money, lead to real lack of capacity and real problems. And the way to have the partnerships strong, and I could certainly say this by some of the groups we studied, the groups that had really spent time naming their mission, naming their values, knowing who they were, what they were about, were in a stronger position than to negotiate and to be clear to say what contracts we will sign and what contracts we won't sign. Mm-hmm. But know who they are, rather than an organization defining itself as a consumer of a particular government program. Because then they're totally at risk and ultimately will be determined, be it exploitive or not, by government goals. Mm-hmm. I think that makes a big difference.
Well, and certainly many faith-based organizations in the social economy, as a matter of principle, don't take any government money and don't want to or don't miss it or whatever, and that's a legitimate option. It wasn't one that the particular organization I worked for, I mean, I didn't institute that. It had already taken that on. And, you know, it's like any other money comes with attachments. And you don't have to take it, but if you do, you sometimes... And, you know, frankly, it can be... the government's more formal about it and more has a lot more experience with it, but individual donors can attach strings to their donations. And you can end up going in that direction.
One last person?
Specific context. In Wetaskiwin, where this group is trying to start a project that would start with a homeless shelter and then go through housing first model, one of the big stumbling blocks is buy-in from city council. So they don't feel that it's their responsibility to take care of these people. It's federal government, it's Hobima. How as a faith-based organization, what do you bring into those discussions that I don't have to shame them into thinking that it's their responsibility, but you know, I don't know what you how do you get them to buy into that?
It's really tough. We Bob and I both live in the inner city, and even getting our own community to buy into it and then to the broader notion. But I think by I think a particular opportunity or resource that faith-based organizations can bring to the table is holding up this notion of community and this notion of diversity and inclusion, this notion of, it is the federal government, legally they should be looking after the Aboriginals, and the provincial government, well, housing is in their mandate, they should be doing it. But at a very realistic level, whoever's responsibility it is, these poor homeless people are actually in your city.
Right.
And so, yeah, the other two levels of government ought to be doing with it, but, you know, how much longer do you continue to use that as an excuse for not doing what needs to be done? But then to bring through your faith tradition and the kinds of discussions you can have and the way our faith can help us overcome fear of the other, fear of those who are different, fear of what will happen if we lose control of our monolithic communities. Those are gospel messages that we ought to contribute to the debate.
Right.
And we have the opportunity to challenge members of our own community to say, it's not that property values are unimportant, it's not that we don't want a nice, safe community for ourselves and our kids, but there are also some other values, and maybe we can find a way to do both. Maybe we can find a way to reach out to people that need our help.
And maybe this closes, maybe another way of looking at that. And I'm going to go one specific housing organization I've been involved with in inner city Edmonton. First two projects are small, no government money. Fundraising, faith money. To get into the game, to get the experience, to get the knowledge, but from the beginning in advocacy, because you know what you're talking about. You know the needs at the end of the day better than the government knows. You know the game better than they do. And with that is relationship to media. Begin to relate to other organizations and systems. And through that, beginning to move to a position where you can negotiate with some credibility, be it government money or more deeper, more sophisticated sources of money from other places. And you can do it on a sense, again, of saying, this is what we need. We'll accept this, we won't accept that, because this will take us in a direction we know that's unhelpful.
For this project, there is provincial money available, but every municipality has to have a plan for their own homeless project for what they're going to do. And if you have a council that refuses to look at
it... it's not even... That's a tough starting point. So maybe just setting an initial public debate, saying, what are we about?
Yeah, that started already.
And then you can come out of the closet and be evangelical like Martin was, in the face of the politicians, at least.
Well,
I have, I want to say how much I appreciate both the work and the thinking of both of you around these issues. And I'm sure I say that on behalf of all of us. So thank you so much.